From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Anthony Fauci, the country's top infectious disease expert, told a House committee today he's seeing a disturbing surge of COVID-19 cases in places like Texas, Arizona, and Florida.
Florida now has more than 100,000 confirmed cases, a quarter of those in Miami-Dade County, where hospitalizations have been rising for nearly 2 weeks. Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez joins us now. The mayor's job is nonpartisan, but he is a registered Republican. Mayor, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing fine. So back in March, you ordered bars and restaurants to close down as the whole country shut down. At that point, you had fewer than 100 new cases a day in the whole state of Florida. Now Miami-Dade alone is seeing more than 400 new cases a day. So my question to you is, if a shutdown was appropriate then, why is it not appropriate now?
No, I don't think we can go back right now. We ran a study with the University of Miami and found that actually probably over 200,000 people had already had the virus here in Miami-Dade. So the numbers is not what's alarming to me. What's causing me concern is that the rising number of the percentage of positives. And so we were hovering around 5-7% positive of the tests that were being administered. Now it's spiked, and we're now over on a 14-day average over 10%. And we always wanted to stay under 10%. In terms of hospitalizations and hospital beds that we have available, it's not getting anywhere close to capacity. The troubling aspect of this, we've seen a huge spike in people 18 to 34 that are testing positive. Does that correlate to the protests? Is it because young people think that this virus is not likely to hit them hard? Are they not taking certain precautions? I certainly saw that on last Saturday when I ran around Miami Beach. A lot of people on the street, nobody was wearing a mask, nobody was social distancing. And so last week I ordered a crackdown on businesses here in Miami-Dade to make sure that people were complying with the rules. The rules that we put in place will work if people will follow them.
And so well, let me ask you, because a lot of the mayors from your county in different cities last night met and decided to put in place mask requirements. Do you support those mask regulations? Do you think they should be for the whole county?
Well, I'm going to talk to my medical advisors today about that. In the cities, I could see where that would make sense because it's much more dense. But in the unincorporated areas of Miami-Dade, it's a lot different. People don't live the same way. Most of them are living in single-family homes. They're not in apartments. I got to take a look at that. I don't think it's a bad idea to do it in those cities. However, the issue is then, you know, it's not the measure. It's the enforcement. You can order all the mask wearing that you want, but if people are starting to gather in individual homes and basically partying and doing things that they shouldn't be doing, that really is going to undo everything that we're trying to do. So the message has to be to the young people, it may not be a problem for you, but there is a certain percentage of young folks that it's becoming a problem. Those with underlying medical conditions, this virus could be deadly to those young people. But
so why not enforce the mask regulations then? Why not use your power to enforce the mask regulations?
No, like I said, it's the enforcement issue. It's a lot easier said than done, okay? I've told my police department, and I've also advised the people of Miami-Dade that we're going to be cracking down. A week ago, we started this this process. So, you know, I think it's a good measure, what they did. I got to talk to my medical advisors and see if something that we need to do in Miami-Dade as a whole.
Let me ask you about President Trump, because he does not wear a mask in public. He is not asking attendees at his rallies to wear masks. Do you worry about the message the White House is sending about masks to, let's say, people in your county?
I think everything is important. I wear a mask, you know, wherever I'm outside or I can't maintain social distancing. I wear a mask when I'm inside, because it is important for the people to have that visual. Look, we've had incidents here in Miami where, you know, some mayors did not wear masks when they were supposed to be wearing masks and they were caught. And that's not a good message. You know, we should be consistent in what we're saying. What we're asking people to do, we ought to do ourselves.
I want to ask you about what the president did yesterday, suspending work visas through the end of the year. That's high-tech visas, hospitality visas, au pairs, corporate executives being transferred around the world. You're in one of the most international metropolitan areas in the United States. Do you think that this is going to hurt you? Do you think that it's a mistake?
Actually, I got to look at the order. I was out of the city. I haven't seen the order or what it applies or what it means. So I don't know what kind of impact it's going to have. But we are an international city, and we are a tech hub. And if it affects that, then, you know, that's something that I need to look at and see how we can mitigate it.
Let me just ask you one more thing, Mayor. I'm sure you saw that President Trump made some comments about being open to meeting with Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela. His administration, as you know, has publicly recognized the opposition leader Juan Guaido as the legitimate mm-hmm. president of Venezuela. Your county is right. home to a lot of people of Venezuelan origin. Do you think it would be appropriate for President Trump to meet with Maduro?
I think he clarified what he meant. He said he would meet with Maduro only to negotiate his exit from Venezuela. That I support. I mean, that's what we need to have. Maduro needs to leave Venezuela. You know, socialism has destroyed Venezuela, just like it destroyed my home country of Cuba. And so if you want to meet him to negotiate his exit, by all means, all right. But to meet him for other purposes, no, I don't support that. But I don't believe that's what the president meant. He clarified that in a tweet yesterday of exactly what he meant. That meeting is just to negotiate his exit. So for that, yeah, I do support that. But for other purposes, I will not support it. I don't think it does any good.
You think it's still possible Guaido could be actually the one in power in Venezuela?
Do I think it's possible? Anything is possible. Do I think it's probable? No, I don't. You know, I'm Cuban. I came from Cuba when I was 6 years old. I've seen this play before. I've seen this movie before. Dictators like that don't normally give up their power easy. Do I believe that he can? Yes, he can. Do I think he will? I'm not so sure of that.
That is Carlos Jimenez, the mayor of Miami-Dade County, Florida. Mayor Jimenez, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. You have a good one.
The federal government reports that more than 29,000 Americans have died of COVID-19 in long-term care facilities since the pandemic began. And in many states, nursing homes account for almost half of total COVID-19 deaths. But in other states like Indiana, it's still difficult to know exactly where the outbreaks are. Side Effects Public Media's Lauren Bavis reports.
Treva Steele visited her father every day after he moved to Greenwood Healthcare Center in Indiana in February. 73-year-old Joe Barton was recovering from open-heart surgery and on a ventilator. On one of her visits, Steele walked into his room and saw him gasping for air. Soon, staff were performing CPR.
And he was basically dying in the bed in front of me.
Barton was rushed to the hospital and got better after a short stay. But Steele was concerned about his care at Greenwood. Nursing homes had restricted visitors to limit the spread of COVID-19, so she wouldn't be able to check on him every day. But he went back to the nursing center in mid-March.
I mean, I almost thought like, okay, great, I'm sending him back to the wolves.
Back at Greenwood, Barton contracted a bacterial infection. He was hospitalized a second time in April and died in early June of factors including complications from COVID-19. Steele wishes she'd had more options for her father, but she found there were limited nursing facilities that could handle patients on ventilators. And in Indiana, it's difficult to tell what facility might be safest. That's because the state doesn't require individual nursing facilities to publicly report their cases and deaths from COVID-19.
It's important for the community to know what might be happening in their backyard.
Sarah Waddell is the Indiana AARP state director. The group is calling for the state to release COVID-19 cases and deaths at each long-term care facility. Now, Indiana only reports total cases and deaths, but not where the victims live. Waddell says that's information consumers need.
I may have a loved one coming out of a hospital, and I want to do a little research about maybe where I want to place them.
The AARP found only about half of states, including neighboring Ohio, Illinois, Michigan, and Kentucky, report which nursing facilities have COVID-19 cases. And some nursing home operators in Indiana have begun releasing that information. Waddell worries that could actually be confusing for families, as facilities may not post the same information or update it regularly.
There's one really simple way to clear that all up, and that's just for Indiana to make the data that they are getting every day available to the public.
The state's data also doesn't line up with new numbers from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Dr. Daniel Rizziniak is the chief medical officer of Indiana's Family and Social Services Administration. He says that could be because of differences in how the data is collected. Here he is at a June 3rd news conference.
We are currently looking into these differences and trying to figure out how we get closer to the real number.
The federal agency says its data is preliminary and will change as more facilities report cases and deaths. And there are already discrepancies. According to the data, Transcendent Healthcare of Boonville in southern Indiana has had 75 COVID-19 deaths. But the facility says they haven't had any COVID-19 deaths or even had a single case. The federal agency's data shows Greenwood Healthcare Center, where Joe Barton was recuperating, has had one COVID-19 death. In reality, the facility has had 35 deaths, according to its corporate owner.
We have strived to not focus on numbers.
Fred Stratman is a spokesman for CommuniCare Family of Companies, which operates 18 skilled nursing facilities in Indiana, including Greenwood. He says the company is in contact with residents and their families, but is not releasing the deaths and cases at each nursing facility to the general public.
Because our residents are not statistics or numbers to us, their faces, their names, their habits, they're people we get to know and bond with.
Before Joe Barton died, his daughter filed a complaint with Indiana's Department of Health about her father's treatment at Greenwood. CommuniCare's Fred Stratman says he can't comment on the complaint, but encourages families to contact their nursing facility's administrator if they have concerns with care. Meanwhile, state data show more than 1,000 long-term care facility residents in Indiana have died of COVID-19 this year. For Here and Now, I'm Lauren Bavis.
Throughout the country, moratoriums on housing evictions are beginning to expire. They were initially established to provide relief during COVID-19, and now some housing experts are warning of a possible rush of evictions that could overwhelm the country's court systems. Here and Now's Christina Kim takes us to North Charleston, South Carolina, where evictions there have resumed.
South Carolina State Representative Marvin Pendarvis was born and raised in North Charleston, so he wasn't exactly surprised when the city ranked first in the country for evictions in 2016. As a teenager living with his mom, he lived through it.
I can remember vividly a gentleman knocking at the door, banging at the door. It wasn't a simple knock. He was banging at the door. And he basically said in some choice words that she needed to be out or something like that. And that scared me.
That experience stayed with him. He remembers going to school the next day in a daze.
It was difficult to focus in school. And you're in math class and you're not even thinking about what's in front of you. You're just like, man, this man told us we got to be out by next week. Why do I even care about school?
It's why during the height of COVID-19, Representative Pendarvis worked to extend the state's eviction moratorium. But those protections expired in mid-May. In the first 2 days after the moratorium ended, the courts received more than 100 new eviction filings. Those new cases are piling up on Nicole Paluzzi's already busy calendar. She's a housing attorney with Charleston's Pro Bono Legal Services.
I have never had regular eviction hearings scheduled 3 or more weeks out. Usually those get scheduled the following week after they're requested. So that is unusual.
And those are just cases from before the moratorium. Getting through the backlog of cases could take even longer as courts adapt to a new normal of safety precautions, including spacing out hearings and making some procedures possible through video conferencing. But there's one court that can't be moved online.
Housing court is generally law on the hall. The litigants come to the building that day. They have not prearranged to have counsel. They may be coming largely unprepared for their hearing. But we use housing court as an opportunity to get these litigants organized with their evidence and try and propose settlement arrangements in advance of the hearing being called.
Housing court was created by a group of legal aid nonprofits last fall as a pilot program to lower the rate of evictions. It provides low-income tenants with day-of legal support. And it's working. Before the pandemic hit, 2/3 of the cases heard in housing court resulted in no evictions, which is why Paluzzi is committed to making sure housing court continues no matter the demand.
If we're not going to do it, nobody's going to do it. It's something that we're very passionate about, especially with things like COVID-19, where people have been furloughed for work. Maybe this is their first time ever experiencing work insecurity. To be able to get them some comfort that we can try and work out this arrangement.
The surge in evictions in North Charleston and nationwide doesn't just impact tenants. Robert Pinniger is the president and CEO of the National Apartment Association. He represents landlords, big and small, across the country.
It has been a roller coaster ride for everybody, I think. The first of every month as we're going through COVID is a time of apprehension for anybody who lives in or operates rental housing, just because of the uncertainty of the economic times we're in.
Pinniger is particularly worried about the smaller landlords, especially those in the so-called C-class housing market, otherwise known as affordable housing. In June, only 4% of tenants in affordable rentals had paid their rent on the first of the month, according to a survey by LeaseLock, which Pinniger says is hurting landlords.
This is not a really high margin industry, so 9 cents of every dollar that is paid would be considered profit. So that goes back to, in the case of the C-class properties, which are owned by a lot of individual operators, this goes back to the person who probably didn't put money in the stock market, but put it in real estate, and this is their retirement.
During the pandemic, he's advised landlords to waive fees and work with renters. But he and the National Apartment Association draw the line on halting evictions entirely.
We're not supportive of blanket eviction moratoriums. They don't allow the operator to properly manage the property. The eviction itself is the only action by which a landlord can take back possession of the unit.
Pinniger says eviction is their legal right, and they're also concerned about courts becoming overwhelmed.
If those delays occur, which have been discussed, there's going to be an extended period in which rent is not going to be paid. And so it's going to cause great distress in the market and in the industry.
If landlords can't collect rent, they could be forced to sell, further shrinking an already tight affordable rental housing market. Back in North Charleston, Representative Marvin Pendarvis has set up a rental relief program. He says while he's sympathetic to landlords, he's more troubled about what might happen to renters.
Many of them don't have the sophistication to navigate this process. Many of them have been preyed on by some of the slumlords that do exist in the area. And if we're not doing things to protect them, then how can we call ourselves a moral and just society?
Pendarvis doesn't believe this eviction crisis can be exclusively solved through the court system. But the resources North Charleston's Housing Court provides can make a difference. And for now, both tenants and landlords are relying on the court to work efficiently. The alternative, housing advocates warn, is an uptick in homelessness and self-help evictions, where landlords take control of a property without going through the legal process, and tenants find themselves without their day in court. For Here and Now, I'm Christina Kim.
Our next guest says the impending eviction crisis is a national problem that could affect millions of people. Emily Benfer is a law professor at Columbia Law School and creator of Eviction Lab's COVID-19 Housing Policy Scoreboard. We spoke about this a few months ago when many states still had protections. Emily joins us now with the latest. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So, Emily, right now, about 40% of those states with protections have let their eviction protections expire, with 23 million people now facing eviction. What has changed and what states are really becoming hotspots?
You're exactly right. At the peak of protection, when we last spoke, about 42 states in the District of Columbia had a statewide moratorium on eviction in place. But those protections are beginning to expire, and about 23 states have resumed evictions, and at higher rates. For example, we're seeing that the Eviction Lab, which created an eviction tracker system, documented a 37% increase in eviction filings in Milwaukee, where housing protections have since expired. In New York City, housing groups are anticipating 50,000 evictions as the moratorium expires. In Massachusetts, 70,000 by January. So on and on, we're seeing there's increased evidence of eviction filings across the country.
This eviction crisis was already happening before COVID-19, which has just exacerbated and accelerated it. How did we get here, especially when it comes to affordable housing?
Even before this occurred, when the pandemic hit, 20.5 million families were already struggling to pay the rent each month. They often had to choose between necessities like food and the rent. Nationwide, only a quarter of renters who need rental assistance actually receive it. And between that scarcity of federal housing support, the loss of 4 million affordable housing units over the last decade, renters are already increasingly vulnerable to eviction. To put this in perspective, 4 evictions were filed every minute in 2016, when the national unemployment rate was 4.7%. Today, unemployment is over 3 times that level.
I mean, which really speaks to something else. Right now, we're seeing this global protest against police brutality and for Black lives. Do you see housing as part of this greater struggle?
Absolutely. I think housing justice and racial justice are deeply intertwined, and the housing crisis is disproportionately affecting minorities. After controlling for education, Black households are more than twice as likely as white households to be evicted. And in multiple major cities, 80% of people facing eviction are people of color. And that rate could increase significantly as eviction moratoriums lift. In fact, in one survey, over 70% of Black and Hispanic adults said that they did not have the emergency funds to cover 3 months of expenses, whereas about half white adults said the same. And I think this inequality is in great part due to the longstanding effects of racially discriminatory housing practices in lending and zoning policies such as redlining. Today, white families have more than 10 times the wealth of Black families. And making matters worse, families lost all homeownership gains made over the last 50 years due to predatory lending practices in the early 2000s and the foreclosure crisis that followed.
Emily, what can be done to address this inequity right now?
It's an excellent question. I think as an immediate measure, the federal government should create a nationwide moratorium on evictions to buy us the necessary time to provide the rental assistance that will sustain renters, states, and local governments in the housing market.
But Emily, what do you say to landlords who argue that eviction moratoriums are not the solution?
I think eviction moratoriums are a stopgap measure. And if they lift before federal financial support is in place, the United States will plummet into a major eviction crisis. And that's going to have negative consequences for property owners, for landlords, for society as a whole. When the rent isn't paid, mortgages and property taxes go unpaid. States, cities, school districts, landlords, banks, the housing market, entire communities suffer as a result.
That's Emily Benfer, Columbia Law Professor and co-creator of the Eviction Lab's COVID-19 Housing Policy Scoreboard. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tech CEOs, including Sundar Pichai of Google, are speaking out against President Trump's decision to suspend several categories of worker visas, including the H-1B visa that many tech companies rely on to bring talent to their companies. While Pichai tweeted that immigrants have, quote, contributed immensely to America's economic success, Trump says he's freeing up jobs for out-of-work Americans struggling because of the coronavirus pandemic. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on member station VPM. And Robin, this order we know goes into effect at midnight tonight. It blocks new visas, not those who already have an H-1B visa. But let's talk about who will be impacted. Skilled workers like engineers and computer programmers, and who else?
Yeah, in addition to the headline of those H-1B visas for tech workers, this suspends H-2B visas for low-skilled jobs. They're H-4 visas for spouses of some pre-existing visa holders. They're J visas for those participating in work and student exchanges, and even L visas that cover intra-company transfers. So within this runs the gamut from, you know, skilled workers, engineers, camp counselors who might come in from Britain. It's fairly comprehensive.
So this will keep as many as 525,000 foreign workers out of the country for the rest of the year. This also comes at a time when unemployment is above 13%. The thinking is Americans don't need more competition. But does the evidence suggest that these visa holders would have taken American jobs?
That's an open question. The lament among tech firms and even the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is that our homegrown talent pool never could quite supply the high-skilled demands of employers here. And so we have to rely on the likes of India, Western Europe, sometimes Scandinavia. But the White House in the executive order is claiming that all manner of special visa immigration right now is, and I'm quoting, particularly harmful to workers at the margin between employment and unemployment, those who are typically last in during an economic expansion and first out during an economic contraction. But Tanya, you did point to a bunch of CEOs pushing back on that, kind of really recoiling at this action.
Yeah, what are you hearing from those businesses? I talked about Google.
Yeah, you have the president, CEO of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is like no left-wing tool necessarily, putting up a not welcome sign for engineers, executives, IT experts, doctors, nurses, and other workers won't help our country, Thomas Donahue said. It will hold us back. You have the president of Microsoft saying now's not the time to cut off our nation from the world's talent or create uncertainty and anxiety. And you saw a lot of that echoed by executives. Go on Twitter. You'll see them from Amazon, Google, Apple, Tesla. So at least, California is firmly against this.
Yeah, this decision comes, as we know, as the president campaigns for re-election. How much of this is just politics?
You have to wonder if this is all about that base. I mean, President Donald Trump took quite a hit when the Supreme Court just ruled 5-4 against him that the administration could not block DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program. So at the same time that he's hurting in the polls, the economy is, quite down. November's not far off, and we're already scheduling presidential debates. This is about deliverables. This is about being able to turn to voters and say, look, you wanted me to renegotiate NAFTA, I did. You wanted some modicum of immigration reform. Even if the Supreme Court blocked me, I came back and did what was in my power with this executive action.
Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on member station VPM. Thank you, as always.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
The coronavirus pandemic has upended just about every business in America, including the budding marijuana industry, which has gone from illegal to being considered essential in many places. Joining us now is Jeremy Burke, who covers the cannabis industry for Business Insider. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Jeremy. Always good to talk to another Jeremy.
Absolutely. It doesn't happen very often. So in most of the states where marijuana is legal for adult use or for medical use, the dispensaries have been deemed essential businesses during this pandemic. How have the sales been so far during the pandemic?
I mean, as you would expect, sales have been really strong over the course of this pandemic. I think April was one of California's best months ever. They sold about $250 million worth of cannabis. So, as you could expect, cannabis probably makes quarantine, makes Netflix binges a little bit more fun, and people have been buying lots and lots of product.
And have the dispensaries had to change the way they operate? Have they been doing curbside pickup or home delivery rather than in-store purchases?
They have, yeah. So delivery services were always a thing. I mean, in legal states like California, there's companies like Ease that have a pretty good monopoly, or did have a pretty good monopoly on the delivery network. But also, companies have been able to open curbside pickup, things like drive-through windows. So they're operating. They're trying to obviously minimize human contact, but they're definitely operating, definitely trying to stay open.
And what are they doing about the money that has to be spent to buy the marijuana? Because it's typically a cash business because of banking regulations. Has that changed as a result? Because a lot of places don't want to take cash right now.
That's been a difficult question. There are dispensaries that do take debit cards. There's a certain fee on those transactions. Other ones use things like Cash App or Venmo or any sort of third-party processing. So there are ways to get around that, but you hit the nail on the head. I mean, that's a big problem, at least for most people that want to purchase it. Cash is one of the, best ways to transmit germs, and that's a difficult problem to get around.
Now, when it comes to a federal solution, marijuana remains illegal under federal law, the use of it. So that means that no one in the industry, dispensaries or growers, can get any federal relief as other businesses have. How has that affected the cannabis industry?
It's a really big problem, not only for the businesses themselves, but think about the workers. So there's really high unemployment, and a lot of workers cannot file for bankruptcy. So they can't refinance their mortgage, get help with medical debt and things that any other workers in any other industry can get access to. There's been a couple court cases that have tried to figure out this problem, and they've sort of been shut down. I mean, the conflict between state and federal law remains, and there's no easy way around that. On top of that, for companies, let's say you are a smaller startup, you have one dispensary. If you had to close that store for any amount of time, I mean, retail is a tight margin business, and they're locked out of Small Business Administration loans. So they're not really eligible for much of the bailout help.
Have they seen a lot of job losses as a result?
They have seen a lot of job losses. The industry has been a little bit more adept at maneuvering that because they've been deemed essential. But still, I mean, there's a lot of unemployment in the industry. A lot of things like growers who, it's part-time labor, sometimes it's migrant labor, they have struggled to staff those facilities. Retail employees, dispensaries have had to sort of pare back. And not only that, I mean, it's corporate offices too, right? When expenses get tight, people get cut. So there has been a lot of layoffs in the cannabis industry, but compared to other industries, they've been doing okay in that front.
What's been going on with the efforts to legalize weed in states where it is not yet legal? Has the whole pandemic and all the changes that have happened affected the push in some places?
Yeah, so let's take New York for an example. You know, Governor Cuomo begrudgingly, I guess, supported marijuana legalization. And you know, the House has been trying, New York State House, I should say, has been trying to get it done for the past two legislative sessions. That has been harder to get done than I think many of them expected. It's not quite as easy as just changing a bill and saying, okay, now it's legal. You have to figure out, you know, where the tax revenue goes, how the licensing structure works, how to ensure that equity applicants, that minority groups get preferential access to what is hoped to be an economic boon. So that has all been shelved with the coronavirus pandemic. Complicated legislation like cannabis legalization is really hard to do when you are battling a pandemic and trying to get people, you know, essential healthcare.
Although you would think that given the tax revenue possibilities from something like cannabis sales, especially when you've got states that are really worried about their budgets in the coming year, that that would help convince maybe some lawmakers who might be on the fence.
It's true. It's definitely true. I mean, that I've seen that argument out there, and that's true that it can help sort of pave over budget shortfalls. That being said, you know, it's a long way from legalizing cannabis to creating a recreational market to actually getting that tax revenue.
Let me just finally ask you, as somebody who covers the industry, what did you think about the fact that this industry that until recently in a lot of places was not even legal, all of a sudden gets declared an essential business during the pandemic?
It's a really, really surprising thing to me that cannabis, which was once demonized by law enforcement and demonized by a lot of society, became an essential business. It's quite a revolutionary shift in people's mindsets and, you know, I think the country's viewpoint on an issue. It's pretty unlike a lot of issues we've seen. I mean, just think about the recent Supreme Court ruling. I think gay marriage is one of the few issues where we've seen such a rapid shift in public perception like cannabis. But, you know, it's really hard to predict, right? Like in 2010, you would have never thought we'd be in a pandemic, never thought we'd be in a pandemic where one of the few activities you can do outside your home is go buy legal cannabis.
That is Jeremy Burke, who covers the cannabis industry for Business Insider. Jeremy, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Jeremy.
Well, now to some extreme weather. A huge dust storm will hit the continental United States later this week after traveling thousands of miles across the ocean from the Sahara Desert. And the highest temperature on record was just recorded in the Arctic Circle. For more, we're joined by Matthew Cappucci, a meteorologist with the Capital Weather Gang at the Washington Post and member station WAMU. Matthew, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, and experts are saying this is the most concentrated dust storm in decades. How big will it be and how did it travel so far?
So this is dust from the Sahara Desert that's already made it 4,000 miles west across the Atlantic. On Sunday, it was in Antigua and the Leeward Islands, Monday in Puerto Rico, and now it's reaching the Greater Antilles and the Yucatan Peninsula with visibilities down to 3 miles at times in areas that would otherwise see clear visibility up to 10 miles. Now, Wednesday through Friday, we're talking areas like the Western Gulf, Texas through the Arklatex, southern Mississippi Valley by Friday, and perhaps even the Tennessee Valley, southeast, and the Mid-Atlantic over the weekend.
Now, we're getting used to seeing kind of weird weather these days, but this is pretty weird, right? To have a dust storm like this in the east of the United States?
Yeah, this is bizarre. We could be talking cities like Houston, New Orleans, Little Rock, Birmingham, and maybe even places like Nashville or Atlanta. I personally can't remember seeing things like this before. In the past, we've seen dust reach the United States, but usually in much lesser concentrations. So to have this really diaphanous just shield of dust make it all the way across the Atlantic in concentrations like this is extremely impressive. And we also have to talk about health effects as well, because you have to keep in mind, these are the smallest particulates that are reaching these far western regions. So if we get the dust down to the surface at all, we could actually be talking about some perhaps respiratory issues for people who are sensitive, things like that as well.
Let me just ask you about one other thing. We mentioned the Arctic Circle recording its highest temperature on record in a Siberian town. 100 degrees?
Yeah, this was something that was so bizarre, it took me a while to actually process. So it was in the town of Verkhoyansk, which is about 3,000 miles east of Moscow, up in Siberia, which, just to give you some bearing, is roughly 1,300 miles farther north than Fairbanks, Alaska. They hit 100 degrees on Saturday, which is the northernmost 100-degree reading on record, and also the warmest temperature ever recorded in the Arctic. So I had to ask myself, was this legit? Well, Sunday also hit 95.3 degrees, lending credence to the 100-degree reading, and a nearby weather balloon measured 70 degrees a mile up in the atmosphere. So when you extrapolate that down to the surface, it makes sense. The World Meteorological Organization preliminary accepted it, and so I was shocked to see, but yes, it is indeed a legitimate reading. And we have data there going back to 1885. That's 130 plus years of data. We've never seen anything like this before. And we can't just say, hey, this is climate change. What we can say, events like this made much more likely thanks to climate change in one of the fastest warming regions of the entire world.
And a place, obviously, with a lot of ice. And now there are going to be more concerns about that ice continuing to melt. Matthew Cappucci, meteorologist at The Washington Post and WAMU, thank you.
Thank you.
Patagonia, REI, and The North Face are among the latest companies pulling their advertising from Facebook and Instagram. They cite Facebook's, quote, repeated failure to meaningfully address the vast proliferation of hate on its platforms. For more, we're joined by Shireen Ghaffari. She's a reporter for Recode. Shireen, welcome.
Thank you.
So I mentioned Patagonia, REI, and The North Face. What other companies have said they're pulling their ads from Facebook so far?
So Patagonia and The North Face are probably some of the biggest brands, but Upwork, a networking site for freelancers, has also pulled its ads, as well as some other companies that belong to the same parent company as The North Face. So that's companies like JanSport, Timberland. Those are all brands within the same group.
Yeah, and this is part of a campaign called Stop Hate for Profit that was started by organizations, including the Anti-Defamation League and the NAACP. What are they saying about why they chose to do this now?
Yeah, so they're saying that Facebook over the years has shown a, quote, repeated failure to meaningfully address the vast proliferation of hate on its platforms. They argue that, you know, it's not just a one-time thing, but that they feel Facebook has a history of sort of letting hateful speech rise to the top on its newsfeed. Facebook disputes this, but I think the straw that broke the camel's back here was really Facebook's inaction on a post by President Trump, in which he said, when there is looting, there will be shooting. And many saw that as an incitement to violence against protesters, and specifically against people of color who were out there and protesting police brutality and racism in this country.
Mm-hmm. Facebook is a wealthy company, to say the least. They had about $70 billion in ad revenue last year. Is this boycott a real threat to their bottom line? And what have they said so far about it?
Well, Patagonia spent about $1 million on Facebook ads last year. And as you said, Facebook's total ad revenue is $70 billion last year. So really, one company like Patagonia pulling out their ads is a drop in the bucket. However, if other major brands start to also boycott the company, I think we could see a real impact.
Hmm. You spoke to Facebook employees, and many are upset that CEO Mark Zuckerberg has taken this hands-off approach to content posted by President Trump, even as he reportedly called some of the content disgusting in private. What are you hearing from inside of the company?
Right. So, you know, Facebook is a large company. It's hard to say for sure how everyone feels, but there is kind of a growing group of people within Facebook's workforce who think the company isn't doing enough to moderate what politicians are saying. And they feel that Facebook is letting politicians like Trump say whatever they want because there's this sort of exception to the general rules for people who are newsworthy, saying that even if a leading world figure says something that is misleading or racist, we should still allow it to stay up because it has inherent news value. And I think employees are starting to question that, and they're starting to really put pressure, some of them, on Mark Zuckerberg and say, hey, can we at least put up a kind of label that says this information is misleading or this information is viewed as violent? And that's sort of what Facebook's competitor Twitter has done in recent weeks in response to Trump's post. So many Facebook employees say, well, why can't we do the same?
But, you know, there's been pressure inside and outside of the company before. I mean, Facebook has weathered boycotts from users and advertisers. Do you think that we'll see any significant change in how it operates?
I don't think, a Patagonia boycott alone would change the company's stance on anything. I do think that when you're seeing kind of a combination of pressure from both advertisers, employees from within, as well as just the broader kind of public and these leading civil rights organizations like the NAACP, I think that is kind of a storm of pressure again that could at least push Facebook to sort of reconsider some of its stances on these issues. But they haven't come out either way yet about what they're going to do.
I want to ask you about another company before we go. Google is also under pressure for its employees to do more in support of Black Lives Matter. This has been going on for several years, but now we're at this moment of reckoning in our country. Is this a bigger shift we're seeing overall in Silicon Valley?
I think so. I think, you know, it's even broader than Silicon Valley. But in general, I think employees of major corporations are starting to question if just putting out a statement saying Black Lives Matter is enough. And they're starting to ask whether the company in its business practices is perpetuating racism or hate in any way. You know, employees are bringing up some really tough questions and pressing their companies on important issues, like whether tech companies should sell their software to police and whether they need to diversify their upper ranks. And in Facebook's case, you know, whether they need to take a closer look at how they're moderating hateful speech as well as politician speech.
That's Shireen Ghaffari. She's a reporter with Recode. Shireen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.